Welcome. Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa.
The issue has come up in a number of constituent groups that have talked to me, both for and against. And so I'm sure it's an issue that we will have quite a bit of discussion about during the session. There's a couple of issues in particular. One is there's a concern that I've heard that our bonding and liability limits are not very high here in the state of Iowa. We may look at if we need to raise those to a higher limit to cover, you know, if there ever was a spill. The other issue that I'm going to be asking of some of the people on the utility board is whether a company that builds either a pipeline or electrical line through the state but doesn't provide any electricity or gas or oil for customers in the state of Iowa is whether they actually do qualify as a utility. If they don't qualify as a utility, then they shouldn't be allowed eminent domain rights.
That was Dave Dio, representative of Iowa's House District 49, comprising Huxley, Nevada, Story City, Radcliffe, and Hubbard, talking, of course, about the back-end pipeline. Today is the first day of Iowa's legislative session, and later in the show, we'll talk with legislators about what's on the environmental agenda. I'm one of your hosts for today's show, Greta Anderson, together with a familiar name and voice in these parts, Loris Elson. Hello, Loris.
Good morning, Greta, and hello to you out there in KHOI listening land.
Loris has been spending time recently with the KHOI team of reporters and producers. Some of you might know Loris as the former editor of Des Moines Register's Ames section and the former owner of Ames News Online, or as a candidate in the recent Story County supervisor race. Loris is a dedicated observer as well as participant in local politics, and we are glad to be able to bring her, bring that expertise to our reporting at the station.
Well, thank you. I'm enjoying being around the commitment and the energy that all of the volunteers here have at KHOI. It's great.
Local Talk begins this morning with a discussion about what appears to be the pending failure of Co-Opportunity Health, one of only two insurance companies offering Iowans health insurance through the new marketplace exchanges created by the Federal Affordable Care Act.
Co-Opportunity Health was one of the new consumer-run cooperative insurance companies formed nationwide, specifically designed to offer competitively priced health insurance to previously uninsured and underinsured people. Co-Opportunity Health offered health insurance through both individual policies and small business group policies in Iowa and Nebraska. The Iowa Insurance Division took over management of Co-Opportunity Health on December 23rd, concerned about the insurance company's low cash reserves and future cash flow shortages. Iowa Insurance Commissioner Nick Gerhardt has issued a statement to Co-Opportunity Health's customers, advising them to look for other health insurance coverage, although the state has not yet officially declared Co-Opportunity out of business. I spoke with Iowa Insurance Division spokesman Tom Alger late Friday afternoon. He said that of Co-Opportunity Health's estimated 110,000 customers in Iowa and Nebraska, about 83% had coverage through small business group policies or unsubsidized premium policies. The other 17% held individual policies with subsidized premiums issued through the Marketplace Exchange. That means they were among the previously uninsured who were helped to purchase policies. Alger confirmed that Co-Opportunity policy holders will continue to have current medical costs paid as long as they continue to pay premiums. He emphasized that those who want to continue receiving subsidized premiums, individual health insurance plans through 2015 will need to sign up with the other companies serving Iowans on the exchange, which is called Coventry One. The sign-up deadline is Thursday, January 15th, if they want their coverage to start in February. This registration period for Marketplace Health Insurance closes after 2015, after February 15th. We now welcome Dr. David Carlisle, who is a geriatric doctor, a family physician, and director of hospice at McFarland Clinic here in Ames. Dr. Carlisle was on the Federal Advisory Committee for the creation of these new health insurance cooperatives. He writes a blog called Conversations with Dr. David Carlisle. Shortly after the state took over Co-Opportunity Health, Dr. Carlisle wrote that he was, quote, saddened by the state's takeover of the health insurance cooperative, end quote. Welcome, Dr. Carlisle.
Thank you for having me here today. I just would ask one small correction. I'm a co-medical director with Dr. Larry Ottoman, so we're both co-medical directors of the hospital.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So
I'm sorry.
That'd be fine.
I apologize. So, I promoted you.
I just want to give appreciation to others. But I welcome being here. I expressed myself in my blog about the what happened here, December 23rd, and I'm happy here to discuss my thoughts. You know, I've been working on efforts to help Iowans receive health care coverage for 25 years, and I've done it in many, many ways. And one of the ways I was most proud of prior to December 23rd was the work I had done with health care co-ops. So it saddened me to find that we were in this situation.
Okay, thank you.
So that came as a surprise to you. We've heard you said in your blog that you were sort of touting Co-Opportunity Health, and as late as November, we had somebody here in the station, an insurance specialist, kind of touting Co-Opportunity Health as a new option for folks. And so, did this news about the financial situation there come as a surprise to you?
Yeah, I had served on the United States Advisory Board to Consumer Operated and Oriented Plan program. I was one of the advisors to help write the regulations for the co-ops. And during that time, I was on it for like a year and 3 months, and it's now disbanded. During that time, I was allowed to observe the formation of what turned out to be Co-Opportunity Health. And so I go back to the very beginnings of Co-Opportunity Health, before it was actually had a name, Co-Opportunity Health. Since it was disbanded, I was on the Quality Assurance Committee for Co-Opportunity Health. So, I had known what was told to me, what was found to be true at the advisory board is that, everyone knew that these new co-ops would be subjected to risk that would be tough for actuaries to determine the proper premiums, because this is a brand new population of patients, many of whom had not had health care, many of whom had unmet needs. And thus, we knew at the advisory board level, and I had heard at the quality assurance meetings, that we were dealing with medical demands that had been tough for actuaries to determine. I had always relied on what I was told that on the United States Advisory Board, that there would be, contingency plans made by the federal government that would allow these unanticipated, these unestimable risk to be protected. And they were called the three R's, and it's very, very technical, and it's beyond me as a non-insurance person to understand. But these three R's were supposed to protect these co-ops. And as I said in my blog, and what I've been told by multiple sources, that Co-Opportunity Health was in line for $120 to $140 million of these contingency payments. The problem was that they were not available at the time they were needed. And they were not available to be used as a loan guarantee to go to a private lender to allow for people to have a bridge loan until these payments were to be made, sometime this summer or this fall. So that's what I know.
Now, I believe Co-Opportunity has received about $146 million so far to help set it up. So this $120 million that you're talking about additional, that's separate from what's already been received. And isn't it separate from the subsidies for individual people right now?
Yeah, I'm going to try in a non-insurance fashion, with only a medical degree to lay the context. The context is that Co-Opportunity Health, which is a cooperative insurance venture that was both in Iowa and Nebraska, had been made with an estimate of anywhere from 11,000 to 15,000 patients or premium holders by the end of last year. And they exceeded those estimates, you know, what I had been told was 100,000 when I last touched base in early December, and the insurance commissioner is talking about 110,000 to 120,000. So they've exceeded their expectations by close to, tenfold. Mm-hmm. You know, they had received about 90 in the area of $90 million plus as a reserve, and as you know, for an insurance company, you need a reserve to kind of run an insurance company. In addition, they received another 20 plus million dollars to start the company. So about 120 is what I know they had received, okay, at the start.
Okay. And with insurance companies, you talked about that $90 million reserve. The situation with co-opportunity is not only that more people enrolled, as I understand it, but isn't it also that with more people enrolling and people having unmet health care needs that were kind of banked up, that they went through that $90 million in paying claims very quickly, correct?
You know, I can tell you just word of mouth is that by the end of the second month, Co-Opportunity Health had requests for 24 major organ transplants. You know, so the people who had applied, at least in the first 2 months, their doctors had requested major organ transplants, 24 of them. So, I mean, so the unmet needs were, considerable. The other thing is, as I talked about in my blog, is that there's certain principles of insurance that you learn if you take an insurance class in college. And one of them is you have to spread the risk. The fact that we had such a poor process to sign people up in Iowa, allowed for the people who really cared the most, the sickest of the ones, would go the extra step to sign up. Whereas many people did not sign up, and those were the healthier ones. So you had a skewed risk. So you had healthy people sitting on the sidelines not signing up because of the problem with the exchange, and you had the unhealthy ones who really needed help signing up. So you could have guaranteed that you were going to have an insurance problem when you're dealing with only insuring, unhealthy individuals.
Well, you said poor process. Was our process more confusing, or can you tell us how it was poor as compared to maybe some other states?
Excuse me. We have, based on different estimates, either the lowest sign-up rate on the exchange in the nation or the second lowest sign-up rate on the exchange. And that was based on several reasons in my mind. And once again, I'm speaking as someone who really cares, a public policy person, but I don't have a position of title, but a position of, but I can tell you that when the determination was made by the state of Iowa that they would allow a grandfather clause, so when people who were on a individual insurance policy already did not have to meet the ACA requirements, that at that point you had people who had insurance but were under pre-existing conditions then were able to move to a policy that allowed their pre-existing conditions to be met, whereas people who already had insurance policy that they reasonably like and they didn't, the rates were that bad, they were able to stay with. You led to a situation where healthy people, stayed and unhealthy people went to places like Co-Opportunity Health or Chemistry. In my mind, the other important thing is Iowa chose not to do a state-based exchange, which was a major mistake. And in my blog, I've talked about it many times, is that the exchange was the public face of the ACA. And by not having a state-based exchange, you didn't have a local connection. You had this federal number out in space. And I think that both those decisions made at the state level, caused us to have such a low exchange rate and thus led to the skewed insurance situation.
Okay. We're talking with Dr. David Carlisle, practitioner of medicine at McFarland Clinic, family medicine, geriatric medicine, also co-director of the hospice program there. Dr. Carlisle blogs at drdavidcarlisle.com. And we are talking with him about the potential or pending collapse of Co-Opportunity Health. Dr. Carlisle, I wanted to ask, why were there only two companies on the exchange for Iowa customers who needed to sign up for health care?
I think that, insurance is a private enterprise, highly competitive, and I think probably other insurance companies realize the danger of competing against a Blue Cross Blue Shield Wellmark, which didn't have to exist on the exchange, which was going to keep their healthy individual patients already. So I think that was an issue of not having more competitors. I think in a couple of years when the grandfather individual policies that aren't do not meet standards of ACA will be gone, I think you're going to have a lot more people on the exchange. But I think people realize this last year, this year, and the next year, it was going to be a tough situation. I think Coventry, I can't speak for Coventry, whether they have just a large amount of reserves or they just wanted to be there, for the public benefits, I can't speak that. The problem real quick is that if you're under 400% of the federal poverty limit and you'll sign up for a policy on the exchange, you'll get a federal subsidy to help pay for you. So those folks who are under 400% and want to sign up, they're paying full insurance rates when they pay for an individual policy separate from the exchange.
Okay. And there was another thing about Cooperative that was special is Cooperative is the only Iowa carrier that was selling the small business insurance that qualified for the special tax credits, right, under ACA, that Coventry, which is owned by Aetna Insurance, actually, was offering individual policies but was not offering the small business coverage. Can you tell me how that may have impacted some of the insurance companies not wanting to get into the exchange, the small business coverage aspect?
Yeah, I think that the thing that was really special about Co-Opportunity Health in my mind was it attempted to be diversified. It didn't try to live off any one element. And they worked out of Iowa, Nebraska. They worked on the individual exchange, but also off exchange on the individual. They did small groups, they did large groups, and they did as you described the shop, the tax benefits. And I know that that was the reason that I think their numbers exploded far beyond their expectations. But how it affected it or how it will affect it, it's kind of beyond my pay grade. I just don't understand the insurance marketplace to be able to speak to that.
Thank you. And I do know that Nick Gerhardt was quoted in an article to Tony Lace of the Register that he said they're trying to figure out some way to work with the federal government to go ahead and see that those small business owners can still get the tax credits because they went ahead and got insurance for their employees based upon the fact that they would get up to 50% back in a direct tax credit or taken off of their tax bill. So thank you. There are 22 other co-ops nationwide, and how are they doing?
My understanding that Iowa, Nebraska, venture called Co-Opportunity Health was the second largest, numbers-wise behind New York, and that at least what I heard from numbers in mid-year, we were by far, the other ones were far, far less for numbers. I think that if you can look at anything regarding Co-Opportunity Health, they should have had some type of ceiling by which they said, I cannot accept more patients without having a higher reserve rate promised by the federal government. And so these other companies, co-ops, I know they're suffering, from what I've been told anecdotally, the same issues with actuarially difficult insurance needs, but my understanding their numbers are low enough that their reserves are able to cover them. Whereas I think, you know, when you go tenfold beyond what you expect, it's not surprising that you're going to probably not have – if your reserves are designed for 15,000 and now you're at 100,000, you know, there's got to be a, you know, a question. The only other thing I'd say is that real quick is, you know, as I said in my blog, one of the other major problem was that, you know, to the benefit of the state of Iowa, Cooperative Health said they would be allowed to be part of the Medicaid expansion. So for individuals from 100 to 133% who would have been gone to Medicaid for any other state who accepted Medicaid, they went on this exchange rate, and Cooperative Health got close to 10,000 patients. You know, the problem was the federal government did not allow Cooperative Health to set a specific premium rate by which to charge the state of Iowa for that. They made them do an average rate across the board. Everyone who knows anything about medicine knows that that area of income has tremendous unmet needs in many areas. And when you're not able to set a actuarially proven insurance premium rate, you were going to lose money, and they did.
I want to get down to the actual patient level and your work as a physician. Had you seen patients come into your office who were new to healthcare, who had recently signed up for healthcare and now were able to get coverage and had some of these unmet needs? Have you encountered this population?
As active as I've been involved in this, I had a number of patients take on Cooperative Health, and some of them were patients I had had for years ago who dropped out of the system because they no longer have health care, and now they had health care. And I can specifically think of a family from Marshall County, a couple in their late 50s, early 60s, who hadn't had health insurance for years and now had health insurance through Cooperative Health. They came in and they got things that they hadn't had done for years. The woman had her mammogram. The man had a colonoscopy. They both had had chronic diseases that they had been limping by, not taking the medicines they should have. So, they had unmet needs that were being met. So, it's a sad story regarding Cooperative Health, but to me, it still shows the essence of why we needed the ACA, the purpose behind the ACA was to provide health care coverage where we didn't have it. And 100,000 people received health care coverage, and to me, for those folks who say, we want to repeal things. You want to repeal things to what, though? Because, to me, the grand bargain with the Cooperative Health was we were still trying to work within the private system to provide health care coverage.
So essentially you're saying what an editorialist in the Des Moines Register said, that now's the time for the conversation about single-payer health care?
I have no problem with how other countries have done single payer around the world. My problem in Iowa, when I look at the unfair Medicare rates of how, Iowa physicians receive payments for Medicare versus other states, when I look at how the federal government, for the last 10, 12 years, every year or twice a year, we have to fight to provide to maintain, just the standard rates of Medicare payments to doctors called the SGR, sustainable growth rate issues. When I look at how, as far as I'm concerned, the federal government did not do well with treating Cooperative Health, it scares me to have a single payer in regards to how the federal government has affected Iowa in the past. So, that's why I was a proponent of change in the private system. I'm reevaluating my thoughts, but I just don't trust the government to make it right. So, I'm in a quandary now, quite honestly.
And if we could take just a second for you to expound upon the fact that states like Iowa, what happens to their reimbursements for Medicare and Medicaid as opposed to what happens in some other states, and why that affects our quality of care.
Well, you know, I think that we have a tremendous quality care in Iowa. It's just that we do it, you know, on a shoestring budget because back in, you know, the 80s, a arbitrary policy was made about how they paid based on cost of living. They've never changed that as, you know, 20, 30 years have changed because of political, because it's a zero-sum game. To take it, to increase ours would take it from someone, and nobody in government's going to allow, you know, New York or Florida to lose out on that care. So, I think we do well, but it still is it's the capriciousness of the federal government, as we all know and have seen before.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. David Carlisle, for coming in, talking to us about this difficult issue, and for serving our community so well.
Thank you.
That was Dr. David Carlisle, Ames physician, blogger, and consultant about healthcare on the national level.
So take me down to the infirmary. Lay me down on cotton sheets. I'll put a damp cloth on my forehead. Lay me down. Let me sleep.
That was Cracker from their album Kerosene Hat, and this is KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, together with Loris Olson.
As we mentioned at the top of the hour, today, January 12th, is the first day of the 2015 legislative session in Des Moines. Though there will be some new faces, the divide in state government will be the same, with Republicans holding control of the House of Representatives and the Democrats, who in this last election year didn't do quite so well, however, did manage to maintain control of the Senate.
And this divide means that bills initiated in the House and those in the Senate may die in committee in the opposite House. But there are some environmental issues that the two sides might be able to work together on.
On the phone, we have a leading Democrat on the Senate Environmental Committee, Rob Hogg, representing Senate District 33 in Cedar Rapids. Senator Hogg has served two terms in the House, and this will be his second term in the Senate. He has a book published last year called America's Climate Century, What Climate Change Means for America in the 21st Century. He's on the line with us today to talk about the Iowa Senate's environmental agenda. Hello, Senator.
Hi, good morning. How are the two of you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
Are things good. Things heating up down there at all?
Well, not really. The lights are getting turned on, and people are starting to roll into the Capitol here. So, it's the first day. I like to refer to this first week of the session as the stand and clap session, because we're going to hear a lot of speeches. So the real work will start probably next week.
Okay. I should also mention that I recorded a conversation with our local representative on the House Environmental Committee, the Republican Dave Dio from Nevada, and we'll hear his comments on a couple of issues as part of this conversation. And, Rob, thank you so much for taking time out on this morning to speak with us today. Let's start off with last year's business, which is funding for Ag Secretary Bill Northey's Clean Water Initiative, a line item funding that initiative and some extra money for REAP, which is Resource Enhancement and Protection, made it through both houses last year, the divided House, the Republican-controlled House and the Democratic-controlled Senate, only to be vetoed by Governor Branstad. Do you think the chances of getting that passed will be any better this year? Are you going to try again? What do you know about that?
Well, here's what I would say about that, is that clearly we have a very large need for additional action to clean up Iowa's waters and improve our natural resources. We have over 480 impaired waterways in the state. On our natural resources side, it's an important part of our economy, and we're facing threats from, like, invasive species that are threatening our forest health across the state. The emerald ash borer is not the only threat there. So we really do have an urgent need for investment in clean water and natural resources. So I don't think there's any question there'll be another effort to increase the funding that we put into those issues. I just think Governor Branstad is out of touch where Iowans are on this issue. We were able to get bipartisan support. It wasn't the hardest sell in the world to get bipartisan support. Obviously, we had to work at it, but advocates across the state had done a great job educating legislators about the need for additional resources for clean water, soil conservation, and natural resource investment. And what I would say is, please just do that again. Just because Governor Branstad was out of touch in 2014 and decided to veto those line items, $9 million for REAP, $11.2 million for clean water, another million, $1.2 million for water supply monitoring. Just because he chose to veto those in 2014 does not mean he'll do it again, because he does need to respond to what Iowans want. And Iowans clearly want clean water and investment in natural resources, so people need to keep speaking up.
Okay. Well, speaking of the Clean Water Initiative, it has been a bit controversial in some parts because many feel it doesn't go far enough to clean up our waters. We've seen the water quality issues raised a lot in this past month or two with the Des Moines Water Works now suing supervisors in three counties upstream of its plant for not doing a proper job with supervising drainage tile outlets. And the resulting very high nitrate levels that are getting into the surface waters that then impact them and their customers. Is there anything else that the legislature can do to move forward with a clean water agenda beyond simply passing this funding for Bill Northey's initiative?
Well, first of all, it is not just Secretary Northey's initiative. I mean, it is the voluntary reduction, nutrient reduction strategy that he has proposed and has been funded. We were also trying to fund in that money. We were also funding soil conservation cost share. There's a large backlog there, and the Watershed Improvement Review Board, which was an initiative of Governor Vilsack in the 2005 legislative session. So this is much broader than just Secretary Northey, and I think people need to understand that. Look, here's the deal. You could try to have government regulate this. There is a role for regulation. It's not about mandates. It's about rules of the game. We need to update our rules to make sure we're protecting our water resources and protecting the Gulf of Mexico from Gulf hypoxia. Secretary Northey has committed Iowa to reducing our contributions of nitrogen and phosphorus by 45%, and that is not going to be achieved with spending $4 million here or $2 million here the way Governor Branstad and Secretary Northey have been approaching it. We need a much larger infusion of resources, and we need to be open to the possibility that there are some rules that are going to have to be updated. There's just no question about that. One of the pieces of legislation I will be sponsoring this year is a proposal to have the legislature endorse Secretary Northey's reduction goals, so to put that into Iowa code, that have that not just be his goal, but to have that be our goal, and ask Governor Branstad to sign that, and plus put a time frame on it. At the current rate that Governor Branstad and Secretary Northey are investing in this, the $4.4 million a year, you know, this is $1 billion-plus exercise. And so even if the government doesn't pay at all, $4.4 million a year has us on a very, very slow course to trying to reduce our nutrients, and we need to do it much quicker. So whether that's more money, updated rules, a combination of both, the biggest thing that advocates can do is to sell the problem and explain that this is a problem legislators need to deal with. This isn't a second-tier issue anymore. clean water and natural resources needs to be at the top of the list.
Okay, well, here is what Representative Dave Dio, Republican from Nevada, on the House Environmental Committee had to say about water quality.
Well, you know, the bill that Bill Northey worked with Iowa State University and University of Iowa and Regents and also with DNR, you know, to put together a couple of years ago, I think is making some really good progress. You know, you could look at just the amount of money that's spent on that and think, well, gee, that doesn't seem like a lot. But the interesting thing is that there's an awful lot of farmers that are doing stuff after they're seeing how well it's worked on some of these operations. They're stepping up and doing some of these new practices on their own, such as cover crops and things like that. I saw a number the other day where a quarter of farmers in the state of Iowa now are trying cover crops, which is tremendous, I think.
What about the most abusive practices that we see in Iowa, such as farmers planting right up to the edge of a creek? I mean, Jim Peace, the wildlife specialist, he paddled many of these rivers and told me he saw, in many cases, this phenomenon of farmers planting all the way up to the creek. In other states, they have limitations against that, and it's legal here in Iowa. Is there any sense that we might create a mandatory setback from rivers and streams?
I hadn't heard any discussion about that as a proposal or a bill, but that's an important issue. I agree. I don't like to see that because once you've destroyed that vegetation right up that close, if you do have a flood, it can change the channel and allows that stream bank erosion, which the DNR experts that I've talked to have told, when I asked them about siltation in lakes and that type of thing, they've told me that probably at least half of it is just stream bank erosion. Stream bank erosion, you know, happens every time you have a large rain event, and it allows the bank to sort of cave in, and you may have a tree that falls in, and then it pulls in the root ball, and you have lots of soil getting in the water. I know for myself, I've been working. We've got a creek that goes through the back of our farm, and I've been working on trying to stabilize a few of the banks that for whatever reason, maybe there's a place where it started to wash out, you know, and I've tried to sort of get some of that seeded down and maybe even change the shape of it so it's not so such, you know, like a direct up and down bank.
That was Dave Dio. Rob Hoag, your response.
Well, I think Representative Dio makes one good point there, which is there are a number of farmers who are who are trying to do it right, and there are more of them doing that thanks to the nutrient reduction strategy. There's no question about that. In the Cedar River, we have 3.5 million acres above Cedar Rapids, and we've been working cooperatively throughout the watershed to try to get people to not only improve water quality, but also to hold more floodwaters to reduce future flood damage. And there's no question there are a number of farmers who are leading role on that. And that's good. Here's what I would say is I would hope that people would remain open to the possibility that, updated rules might help. Because one of the things that I know is frustrating for some farmers is they feel like we do a lot of good things, we work really hard on this, and then they see a neighbor or somebody else on the watershed that's not doing as much. And that can be frustrating to those farmers who are doing it right. So I think we need to be open to the needs for updating our rules. Clearly, we need to be protecting our stream banks and having some sort of vegetated buffers. That's just critical to maintaining water quality and our natural resources. So I think if people can keep an open mind about this and understand we're not punishing farmers. Now, that said, there is a clear need for action, and when you see something like the lawsuit by the Des Moines Water Works, that's reflecting the clear need for action because they are spending a lot of money trying to remove nitrates. In Cedar Rapids, we'd have the same problem, except I think we already spent $10 million on new infrastructure to deal with high nitrates. So it's an issue across the state. And we really need clean water, not just in Iowa because of our impaired waterways, but you go all the way down to Gulf of Mexico, and Gulf hypoxia is costing our country billions of dollars, and we need to deal with that issue as well.
Okay. I also talked with Dave about the pipeline proposed to cross Iowa carrying crude from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. He brought up issues of increasing the state's bonding levels and the issue of eminent domain and whether it applies to a utility that runs through rather than serves the state. Rob Hoag, what is your take on this pipeline?
Well, I think Representative Dio has hit on the two issues, if I understand his comments correctly. One is eminent domain. It is really not right. It is really not right for a private company to be able to condemn Iowa farmland when they're not serving Iowans. So that is a major issue that I think will get attention at the legislature. And the other issue is that our current law only requires $250,000 in financial assurance. Well, look at what the oil spills in other states have done. The Kalamazoo River spill was a $1 billion spill, a billion with a B. The Yellowstone River in 2011 was $135 million spill, and that's just cleanup costs. That doesn't account the ongoing damage and, you know, the degradation of the resources. The Mayflower, Arkansas oil spill in 2013, the initial cleanup cost from that was over $70 million, and Iowa law only requires $250,000 in financial assurance. That is not, that's outdated. Even the state of Alaska requires over $50 million in financial assurance from pipeline operators. So I think that's something the legislature can do. I think we can address eminent domain. Here's the bigger picture on the pipeline. We already have too many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We cannot be investing all this money in the fossil fuel economy. We need to be mobilizing our resources for the clean energy economy and creating jobs and growing businesses here in Iowa for clean, homegrown, renewable energy. And this pipeline is going to be a big scar across our state and threaten our waters. So in my view, we need to pick a different direction as a state.
Well, I knew you were going to go in that direction as the author of the book America's Climate Century on global climate change. And you have that added perspective on fossil fuels and why we might want to reduce their flow, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, if I could just say something on that really quick. You know, nobody asked for this problem, but we've got to deal with it. I mean, it's we're really failing as a country in dealing with climate change, and people need to take a fresh look at it. Wherever they are, take a look at it, figure out how we're going to deal with this, because the greenhouse gas pollution in the atmosphere keeps going up and up and up, committing us to further warming and further climate change, and we've really got to deal with that.
So what can we do in the state here besides grow more corn, which I don't think soaks up all that much CO2?
Well, there are a lot of things we can do, the first thing we need to do is say no to the Bakken oil pipeline. This is just a major step in the wrong direction, and it's not just on greenhouse gases. It threatens our state, our farmland. It threatens our water, and we've just got to say no to it. We're talking about up to over a half million barrels of crude oil a day, and that's a lot of oil, and that's really would threaten our water and our farmland, and of course, just with the scar from the condemnation of farmland. Beyond that, I think as a state, we have an opportunity to embrace a clean energy future. Our solar energy industry is growing quickly. Wind, we've been successful. In the whole area of biorenewables, we need to go beyond conventional ethanol to the next generation of ethanol technology, and start using some of our biomass resources for electrical production. And clearly we need to do a better job on energy efficiency. Every building should be a green building. Every appliance should be energy efficient. We need to ask Iowans to conserve. It saves money. It actually helps our economy. Homegrown clean energy grows our economy, helps businesses, saves consumers monies, and, of course, we can show the world that we can have a vibrant, prosperous economy without dependence on fossil fuels. And that's really something I think Iowa can uniquely do.
And so what specific kinds of proposals might there be?
Well, I think we're going to be looking at a number of things. One of the proposals I'm really excited about is the Bioeconomy Institute at Iowa State. That's one of the areas that if we can fund that university research, we can really start to develop the next generation technologies. And so I think that's something that will be on the agenda in 2015 in the Iowa legislature. One of the things the bioeconomy talks about is building a carbon-negative economy, where not only are you using renewable energy to displace fossil fuels, that would create a zero-carbon or a carbon-neutral economy, but actually using technologies like biochar to sequester carbon dioxide, better agricultural practices to sequester carbon dioxide. There are a lot of things we can do. I guess, one of the things we do early in the legislative session is we talk amongst ourselves and we see what we think might have some traction and might be viable. I know the Bioeconomy Institute is going to be on the agenda. Would like to see legislation authorizing solar gardens so that you don't have to have solar power on your property, but you can invest in the neighbor's solar system. That would be a step forward. Having green building standards for public buildings, that would be a step forward. So there are lots of ways this can go, and one of the things you do early in the legislative session is you sell the problem and you see what kinds of solutions work for other legislators.
Okay, well, I think that's all the time we have for you with you today. We want to thank you for phoning in, and it was a pleasure and honor to speak with you. We wish you well in the 2015 legislative session.
Well, thank you, and I hope listeners will get involved because they can really make a difference by speaking up.
Thanks.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Laura Solson, here with Greta Anderson, and we've been joined in the studio by local artist Tibi Kelchia. Did I get that right?
Yep.
Excellent.
Tibi has an exhibit that is now up at the Octagon Gallery across the street from us. It's entitled Scientific Writing. And I have to say, Tibi, I'm very excited, interested in this exhibit because my day job involves scientific manuscripts, editing scientific manuscripts. So some days I feel like I have scientific writing literally coming out of my ears and my eyes, eyeballs. So Tibi himself, you're a scientist.
Right, yeah, correct.
With advanced degrees in electrical engineering and computer science, and you are employed in this field locally?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So tell us what you've been up to during your creative hours. What kind of works are in this exhibit, Scientific Writing?
Yeah, as the title says, you know, there are works that are somehow related one way or the other to the production of scientific texts. So there are three groups of works, which I call equations, self-resetting latches, and trigonopoetry. So the equations are a set of 18 works which are inspired by mathematical equations, and I take fragments of mathematical equations, abstract them even further, the symbols in those equations, and then create prints and drawings based on them. It's actually each work is a combination of monoprints and drawings in ink and graphite. I was looking at how you are able to express so many things with so few symbols in mathematics. So what I did, I took a bunch of found pieces of wood that kind of had interesting shapes, and using those and printing them in different combinations and different points on the page, I was able to kind of create the feeling of looking at an equation. So rather than seeing the alpha or delta or whatever symbol there, it's you're going to see an abstracted shape of a piece of wood there. So it kind of looks more like an equation rather than being exactly an equation that you can identify and put your finger on it.
Is there hope that maybe a non-scientific-based audience will connect with those symbols?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I certainly hope that, you know, a non-scientific audience would like the works directly, you know, like just the way that they look, even if you're not aware of the entire process that's behind their production, you know. But, you know, like these are, as I said, you know, like there's three groups of works. And these equations are, in a way, the most austere works because, you know, they're kind of just black and white. The others are much more colorful. So if you don't like equations, maybe you can look at the other groups of works, you know. Like, for example, the second group of works, the self-resetting latches is...
self-resetting latches.
Yeah, well, so the title is... the title of a paper that I've presented at an electronics design conference a bunch of years ago. So what I did, I took that paper and turned it into an illuminated manuscript, kind of, you know, like if you know those medieval books that, you know, had handwritten text and images and all sorts of decorations. So I took that paper and turned it into an illuminated manuscript, you know, 4 pages of typed text are... now 15 pages of illuminated manuscript, so everything is done by hand. So hopefully, you know, again, maybe you don't understand what self-resetting latches are, but hopefully you're going to be attracted by how the pages look, by the colors, by, you know, the whole composition.
That sounds very interesting. And tell us about the Trigana poetry.
So the last set of works is a set of 78 paintings. Yeah, well, each one of them is relatively small. It's about 8 by 10 inches. And what I did there, I took an old trigonometry textbook from the 1920s, and then on each page I was trying to create new phrases based on the words that are found on the page. So, you know, once I found a good enough phrase or something that was interesting to me, I was masking those words to keep them from being overpainted. And then I would paint around the rest. And then you would see that the final painting combines, you know, colors, paint, and whatever I, you know, used to create the image, and the words there to create a new phrase. So that's why I was calling them trigonopoetry, poetry based on trigonometric texts.
Found poetry, in a way.
Yeah, kind of found poetry, yeah.
How long did it take you to make these works, put this collection together?
About 2 years.
Oh, wow. You're very prolific.
Yeah, I kind of work pretty fast. Well, so the equations were created in 2009. They were like, took a couple of weeks to create 18 of them. But yeah, the trigonopoetry and the illuminated manuscript are made in the past 2 years.
Okay. Well, that exhibit is up at the Octagon Gallery, the community gallery at Octagon Center for the Arts. The hours for that gallery are 10 to 5 Monday through Friday and 1 to 5 on Saturday. And there will be a reception a couple weeks from now.
Right.
On January 23rd from 5:30 to 7:30. We'll get that on our community calendar. So
right.
Folks,
yeah,
can...
absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be at the same time as the opening for the big clay fiber arts show at the Octagon.
Oh, great. Kill two birds with one stone there. Drink two glasses of wine for
exactly,
one.
Exactly, yeah.
Enjoy a lot of great art. I love the show. And I will have to bring my husband to this one. He's a physicist.
Oh, okay.
So
definitely.
He is going to love this.
Well, yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of hoping to put some posters in the, you know, Department of Computer Science or Engineering at ISU.
Yeah, you've got a good point there. There's a good audience
you've
for that.
You've got an audience. Yeah.
Well, that was Tibby Kelce. Whose art is up at the Octagon in Ames, just across the street from us. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts today, Greta Anderson and Loris Olson.
We first spoke with Ames physician David Carlisle, who is also a consultant on national health care policy, about the possible collapse of Co-Opportunity Health. Dr. Carlisle has a blog, drdavidcarlisle.com, and that's drdavidcarlisle.com, that we'll link to from our website, along with some of the other websites you might want to visit to learn more about Co-Opportunity Health.
And we then spoke with Rob Hoag of the Iowa Senate, who, together with 149 other Iowa legislators, is starting back to work today after elections and the winter recess. And we spoke with him about some of the environmental issues that he hopes to address in the coming session.
We also had some clips from a conversation with Representative Dave Dio, who represents Story County, basically outside of Ames, and he is also on the Iowa House Environmental Committee. Our engineer today was Richard Morrison. Our theme song was Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join our team or if you have a hot news tip, please stop by the station at 410 Douglas Ave or call 292-2878. That's 292-2878.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and see you again on the radio.